Just like great shoes, great books take you places. Through unforgettable love stories and into conversations with characters you'll never forget.
I think any good romance, it gives me this feeling of like butterflies.
I'm Danielle Robay, and this is Bookmarked by Reese's Book Club, the new podcast from Hello Sunshine and iHeart Podcasts, where we dive into the stories that shape us on the page and off. Each week, I'm joined by authors, celebs, book talk stars, and more for conversations that will make you laugh, cry, and add way too many books to your TBR pile. Listen to Bookmarked by Reese's Book Club on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I knew I wanted to obey and submit, but I didn't fully grasp for the rest of my life what that meant.
From iHeart Podcasts and Rococo Punch, this is The Turning, River Road. In the woods of Minnesota, a cult leader married himself to 10 girls and forced them into a secret life of abuse. But in 2014, the youngest escaped. Listen to The Turning, River Road on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I know a lot of cops, and they get asked all the time, have you ever had to shoot your gun? Sometimes the answer is yes. But there's a company dedicated to a future where the answer will always be no. This is Absolute Season 1, Taser Incorporated.
I get right back there and it's bad.
Listen to Absolute Season 1, Taser Incorporated on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the night of April 14th, 1996, a home invasion on Chicago's South Side left 24-year-old Eddie J. Binion fatally shot. The shooter wore a mask, but not all of the assailants did. Soon, one identification led to an interrogation and three more names, one of whom was Robert Johnson. But it appears that violence and threatening teenagers with 80 years in prison might not lead to the most reliable information. This is Wrongful Conviction.
You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. It's Ben Bolin. I'm back to cover a few more cases for Jason. This one takes us to an unfortunately familiar place, Chicago, Illinois. Joining us from the Exoneration Project to help tell this story, Lauren Myerscough-Mueller. Welcome back, Lauren.
Thanks for having us.
And of course, us here includes the man himself, Robert Johnson. Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, Robert, let's start with where you grew up.
Yeah, Inglewood, Chicago, like South Side, 57 in Aberdeen. The neighborhood was a little messed up. I think that's when the drug epidemic really hit hard. It was a bad area, but it was still okay. Like, I was still able to enjoy myself. Me and my brother, we were living with our great aunt, and her name was May Jones. She stood in for my mother and basically raised us like we were her own. And she took care of me from the age 2 to 10. Then she passed away. Then I went to stay with my grandmother. You know, I have very fond memories growing up. I remember one thing that I used to love. Like during Christmas time, my grandfather used to take us to Forest City. We used to ride past all the houses with their decorations and stuff up. Like, I just remember that in my mind. I used to love to do it, like, every year. I mean, you had people that really went for it. Like, it was like they was in competition or something. It was like, but it was real nice.
Well, you haven't been out for Christmas yet, so.
I have not. You know, I haven't even thought that far, but yeah, that's something I definitely would like to do.
Having been released in February of 2025, at the time of this recording, Robert is still experiencing a lot of firsts. having spent more than 28 years wrongfully incarcerated at the hands of at least two detectives who had previously worked under John Burge, the notorious detective commander that ran a torture operation out of Chicago's Area 2 and 3, these men were also involved in cases that we'll link in the episode description, like Marcus Wiggins. By the time of Robert's case, Marcus's mother had already won a civil suit regarding her son's torture that left him with a stutter. So the word was certainly getting around at this time, but kids in Robert's neighborhood already knew.
I mean, they really thought that they can do anything to someone. Like, I remember one time I walked out my house. I walked 3 blocks. By the time I got to the 3rd block, I had been stopped, patted down, and strip searched 3 times, made to pull my pants down so they can see if I had something in my drawers. It's really a blessing that technology has changed and people are able to like just record stuff and get it on camera. But back then they didn't have that. And I mean, it was just notorious in the neighborhood. And they really thought that they was not only the law, above the law.
Did you ever hear about police torturing people around this time?
Yeah, it was a known fact, like already, like if the police grab you, you're getting beat.
It was known maybe in the neighborhoods, but judges were ignoring it and or not believing it. And juries certainly were not believing it. Defense counsel, it kind of depended, but typically they said, we're not bringing that up at trial because no one will believe you.
So we need to remember the context of what's occurring here. This is the late stage of the crack epidemic era. It's a dire social issue, and it leads to the election of a ton of so-called tough-on-crime politicians. These are folks who gave pretty much unlimited leeway to law enforcement, but this didn't really lead to safer streets. The victim in this case was Robert's close friend, Eddie J. Binion.
Yeah, Eddie Binion, Jay, he was my friend. We used to hang out. It was even one time that I ran away from home, and he let me sleep in his house. You know, I ran away from home because, you know, I was mischievous or whatever. You know, my grandfather was like, you gonna come in at this time? And I was like, hey, granddad, you want me to come in at 8 o'clock? Like, that's when everything start. Like, I'm 16 years old or 15 years old. Like, so I lashed out and ran away, but he let me stay at his house a couple of days. And I'm saddened. I was saddened when this happened to him, but I didn't even get a chance to even really process the situation because 2 days later, less than 2 days later, I was arrested or kidnapped, rather.
And the night in question was April 14th, 1996. This is around 10:30 or 11 p.m. This was after Robert's curfew. Other than a short errand for his grandmother, he's at home for the night. But Robert knew the guys who were involved. 20-year-old Jimmy Slaughter, 17-year-old Willie Doherty, 15-year-old Fernando Gilbert, and a fourth assailant.
I was real tight with Jimmy Slaughter, but we all was cool. The only person that I wasn't really cool with was Willie Doherty. I had only known him for maybe 2 months at the most. So on the night of the crime, my grandmother sent me to Leon's, a like food joint, because she was hungry. We both was hungry. And then she sent me to go and get some bread and a pop. On my way to the store, I seen them. They walked past me and they went their way and I went my way.
So there was this group of guys who had this idea to rob Jay Binion because he was selling drugs. A few of them had guns, a couple of them wore masks. And the idea was that initially, Jimmy Slaughter, he also knew Jay. And so he would go in and then he would let the other people in. There were a number of other people in the house, including Jay's girlfriend. And, you know, they were basically all corralled into the back of the house while this search was undertaken for the drugs and the money. The problem was that there, I guess, wasn't as much money or drugs as was expected.
And the fourth assailant, the one who was masked, they shot Jay Binion in the back of the head without, one, a care in the world for this young man's life, but two, that half of his crew, namely Jimmy Slaughter, were not wearing masks and were in view of the people they knew from the neighborhood, like the victim's girlfriend, Shauna Wilkins.
Right. Shauna knew who he was. They called 911. And initially, Jimmy is treated as potentially a witness because they didn't necessarily know that he let these guys in on purpose. And during their interrogation of Jimmy, he has now testified that he was abused, choked, and hit. And they get names out of him. And then they go and pick up these other guys, Willie Doherty and Fernando Gilbert. And at that point, you know, they're playing people off of each other and saying, well, this is what other people are saying. They're already saying it's Robert. And Willie, he was, I think, 17 at the time. And they also abuse him and threaten him. And so he went along with that.
Now, it appears that it was some mix of Robert's known association with Jimmy Slaughter that brought him to suspicion. And the other suspects, Gilbert and Doherty, both looking to save themselves from lengthy prison terms, as well as to avoid being labeled snitches for naming that fourth assailant, who was not named first by the police. And so with all this, it appears to have been a convergence of various agendas that ultimately led to Robert being pegged as the masked shooter.
The 15th, when I came home from school, my grandma told me that the police had called there and wanted to talk to me about a conversation that I allegedly heard. She was like, you know, call him back. But, you know, I never called him because I'm not calling the police. Based on my experience with him, I want to be as far away from him as possible. And then I want to say between 2 to 3 o'clock in the morning, the phone rang and the doorbell ringed at the same time. My grandma went to the door and I heard them ask her, was I there? And she told him, yeah, you can talk to him, but not right now. You know, I'm not going to let y'all talk to him at no 3 o'clock in the morning. So Detective O'Brien, I know his voice because he also testified at my trial. And he was the one that I had the most interaction with. I heard him say, if you don't let us in, we're going to kick the door in. And I heard my grandma say, well, kick it in. But I ain't letting y'all talk to him. I'm not opening this door. And then I heard a slam up against the door. I guess they were trying to intimidate her or whatever they was trying to do. And my grandma came back in. You know, I dozed back off for maybe an hour because they came right back. They rang the bell that time and I haven't did anything. So I was just like, you know, let them in. So initially they told my grandma that we just want to talk to him. We're not taking him nowhere. We just want to ask him a couple of questions. We're going to do that here if it's okay with you. My grandma said, okay. She let him in. They came in. It was about 7 or 8 of them. We sat down in my living room. My grandmother got up to go to the bathroom. And Detective O'Brien said to me, get up right now. Let's go. They didn't even tell me I was under arrest. They just was like, let's go now. They didn't tell my grandma that they was taking me or anything. I said, Grandma, I'm gone. And I found out later on, she didn't even hear me.
So she must have, like, come back from the bathroom and then...
And I was gone.
Just gone.
Yeah, I was gone.
I know a lot of cops, and they get asked all the time, have you ever had to shoot your gun? Sometimes the answer is yes. But there's a company dedicated to a future where the answer will always be no.
Across the country, cops call this taser the revolution.
But not everyone was convinced it was that simple.
Cops believed everything that Taser told them.
From Lava for Good and the team that brought you Bone Valley comes a story about what happened when a multi-billion-dollar company dedicated itself to one visionary mission. This is Absolute Season 1, Taser Incorporated.
I get right back there and it's bad. It's really, really, really bad.
Listen to new episodes of Absolute Season 1, Taser Incorporated on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Binge episodes 1, 2, and 3 on May 21st and episodes 4, 5, and 6 on June 4th, ad-free at Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Welcome to Pretty Private with Ebonet, the podcast where silence is broken and stories are set free. I'm Ebonet, and every Tuesday, I'll be sharing all new anonymous stories that would challenge your perceptions and give you new insight on the people around you. On Pretty Private, we'll explore the untold experiences of women of color who faced it all: childhood trauma, addiction, abuse, incarceration, grief, mental health struggles, and more, and found the strength to make it to the other side.
My dad was shot and killed in his house. Yes, he was a drug dealer. Yes, he was a confidential informant, but he wasn't shot on a street corner. He wasn't shot in the middle of a drug deal. He was shot in his house, unarmed.
Pretty Private isn't just a podcast. It's your personal guide for turning storylines into lifelines. Every Tuesday, make sure you listen to Pretty Private from the Black Effect Podcast Network. Tune in on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Sometimes it's hard to remember, but
going through something like that is a traumatic experience, but it's also not the end of your life.
That was my dad, reminding me and so many others who need to hear it that our trauma is not our shame to carry, and that we have big, bold, and beautiful lives to live after what happened to us. I'm your host and co-president of this organization, Dr. Leitra Tate. On my new podcast, The Unwanted Sorority, we wade through transformation to peel back healing and reveal what it actually looks like, and sounds like, in real time. Each week, I sit down with people who've lived through harm, carried silence, and are now reshaping the systems that failed us. We're going to talk about the adultification of Black girls, mothering as resistance, and the tools we use for healing. The Unwanted Sorority is a safe space, not a quiet space. So let's lock in. We're moving towards liberation together. Listen to The Unwanted Sorority, new episodes every Thursday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
People find it hard to believe or understand why an individual will confess to a crime that he wouldn't do. I personally know why a person would do that. Because I was so afraid that another 10 more hours, I might have would have said something that I didn't do. Don't be so stern when you say, well, I know I wouldn't confess to a crime that I wouldn't do. No, you say that because you have never been inside of one of them interrogation rooms. That's the reason why I'm not mad at Willie Doherty, Jimmy Slaughter, or Fernando Gilbert, because it is pressure. And it's like, how do I help myself? That's the only thing you're thinking about. Survive. How? So, I mean, I kept on telling them that I wasn't involved, and they just wouldn't listen to me. They was all in my face, screaming and hollering, and talking about, we know you had something to do with this. Your co-defendants is saying it's you, that you killed Jay. You better tell us something, or you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison. But I just kept on telling them, no, I didn't have nothing to do with this. You know, I never wanted to say anybody's name because, you know, where I come from, that's frowned upon and you can be killed. But as they began to show me all type of statements and stuff, it seemed like that they are really trying to pin this on me. So I said what I thought was going to shed some light on the individual that was involved. Like, hey, it wasn't me. I seen these individuals together that night. You know, they looked at me like, what else?
But he never said anything else, just the names of the four guys that he had seen walking together that night, three of whom had already given statements, and one of whom, Willie Doherty, had repeated what the police had said, that Robert was the fourth assailant.
At some point, I was charged with first-degree murder, armed robbery, and home invasion. And like I say, another 5 more hours, ain't no telling what I would have said. My bond was like $500,000 or something like that, 50 to walk. You know, my family didn't have that type of money. So I was in custody the duration of my trial.
In the meantime, the three other guys are looking for the best deal.
Right. So all of them filed motions to suppress their statements, alleging different levels of mistreatment or abuse. But the big thing that happened was with Willie Doherty, who was 17 years old, terrified, had been abused by the police, and forced to falsely implicate Robert to begin with. He filed his own motion to suppress his statement, which then was withdrawn when his lawyer came to him with this offer, which was 15 years at 50%. So 7.5 years for a murder in Chicago if he would testify against Robert. And if he didn't do that, he was looking at 80 years, which is what Robert ended up getting. And so he was told, you know, it's either you or him. Like, he'll take this and testify against you and walk free in 7.5 years, or that's what you can do. So Willie thought that it was kind of his only chance at a life. So he ends up accepting that. And the other guys, they did not testify against Robert, but they were allowed to make that same deal. You know, they were like, well, Robert's going down anyway. Let's just save ourselves.
Robert's trial began a little over a year later. This is on May 13th, 1997. And as Robert mentioned, Detective O'Brien testified, but the substance of his testimony appeared to do little more than affirm in the record that he had done everything by the book.
Detective O'Brien say he came there to arrest me and told my grandma that I was under arrest and that if she wanted to, she can accompany me. Then he said that my grandma declined.
And at this point, you're 16?
16. Now, any rational person knows a grandmother? Like, grandmothers don't play about their grandchildren now, for real. It ain't no way that she would have declined to come with me.
And perhaps the subtext there was, even this kid's grandmother doesn't think he's innocent. However, that is undercut by one of the state's only eyewitnesses, Shauna Wilkins, the victim's girlfriend we mentioned earlier. She had an obvious interest in getting the right person, and she testified to Robert's innocence.
The girlfriend who witnessed everything testified she did not see Robert there. She knew Robert because, as Robert said, he was friends with Jay and he'd been around. And she said the same thing, knew his voice, did not recognize his voice or him as one of the perpetrators. Jay's sister also testified that Robert was very close friends with her brother.
She was only able to testify to us being close friends. When my attorney tried to ask her, did you believe that Robert was involved? I believe she answered the question, no, but I think the judge told the jury to disregard it. But the fact that she got up there and testified, I think should have helped, but it didn't.
So it appears that the state's star witness, Willie Doherty, was enough to convince the jury.
That's the only evidence against him, and yet he was still convicted. Because back then in the 90s, and still some, a lot of the time today, but especially then, if someone's sitting in the defendant's chair, the jury assumes they did it. Because to get to that point, the prosecution, the police believe you did it, so you must have done it. Or at least done something.
But a part of me was like, you mean to tell me not one person out of 12 people can't say, wait a minute, hold on. Here is a guy that's taking a plea deal. We know that he was involved because he's saying he was involved. And he's being offered this deal, and he's going to walk up out of here because we had already been there for about a year and a half. So he was going to go home in less than 6 years versus him getting 80 years. And it's the only thing they got here? I just would have thought it was somebody that would have been like, wait a minute, I don't believe this. I'm not convicting this kid because that's what I was.
So Robert had the 55 years on the first degree murder. And then 25 years on the armed robbery and the home invasion, those two were concurrent. So it added up to 80 years.
When the guilty verdict came in, I put my fist in my mouth and I just bit down on it as hard as I could to somewhat compose myself. I began crying. I had a public defender. His name was Bob Galhotra. I remember he put his hand on my shoulder, and while it may have been a simple gesture in that moment, I needed that.
I know a lot of cops, and they get asked all the time, have you ever had to shoot your gun? Sometimes the answer is yes. But there's a company dedicated to a future where the answer will always be no.
Across the country, cops call this taser the revolution.
But not everyone was convinced it was that simple.
Cops believed everything that Taser told them.
From Lava for Good and the team that brought you Bone Valley comes a story about what happened when a multi-billion-dollar company dedicated itself to one visionary mission. This is Absolute Season 1, Taser Incorporated.
I get right back there and it's bad. It's really, really, really bad.
Listen to new episodes of Absolute Season 1, Taser Incorporated, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Binge episodes 1, 2, and 3 on May 21st, and episodes 4, 5, and 6 on June 4th, ad-free at Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Welcome to Pretty Private with Ebonet, the podcast where silence is broken and stories are set free. I'm Ebony, and every Tuesday, I'll be sharing all new anonymous stories that would challenge your perceptions and give you new insight on the people around you. On Pretty Private, we'll explore the untold experiences of women of color who faced it all: childhood trauma, addiction, abuse, incarceration, grief, mental health struggles, and more, and found the strength to make it to the other side.
My dad was shot and killed in his house. Yes, he was a drug dealer. Yes, he was a confidential informant, but he wasn't shot on a street corner. He wasn't shot in the middle of a drug deal. He was shot in his house, unarmed.
Pretty Private isn't just a podcast. It's your personal guide for turning storylines into lifelines. Every Tuesday, make sure you listen to Pretty Private from the Black Effect Podcast Network. Tune in on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Sometimes it's hard to remember, but
going through something like that is a traumatic experience, but it's also not the end of their life.
That was my dad, reminding me and so many others who need to hear it that our trauma is not our shame to carry, and that we have big, bold, and beautiful lives to live after what happened to us. I'm your host and co-president of this organization, Dr. Leitra Tate. On my new podcast, The Unwanted Sorority, we wade through transformation to peel back healing and reveal what it actually looks like and sounds like in real time. Each week, I sit down with people who've lived through harm, carried silence, and are now reshaping the systems that failed us. We're going to talk about the adultification of Black girls, mothering as resistance, and the tools we use for healing. The Unwanted Sorority is a safe space, not a quiet space. So let's lock in. We're moving towards liberation together. Listen to The Unwanted Sorority, new episodes every Thursday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I actually was shipped to Stateville at 17, yeah. That place is a nightmare. And it's, you know, grown men here. You immediately know that my childhood, that's over with. Ain't no more child, ain't no more, hey, I'm a kid. You have to grow up fast. Ain't no games, ain't no plan. You need to learn how to survive quick. What to do, what not to do, the rules. You need to understand all this or lose your life. My mind couldn't accept the fact that I was about to spend 80 years of my life under these conditions. What I mean is hell, being there for something you did do. But to wake up every day knowing that you didn't have nothing to do with this, that is, I don't even know the word for that. And I seriously contemplated taking my life. Like, I was really close. I remember times that, and I went through this for a few years. Like, I'd hear a phone ring and be like, oh, well, maybe that's them calling to say, yeah, he ain't had nothing to do with that. Y'all got the wrong guy. Like, let him out. We made a mistake. But, you know, the call, it never came. My family was a real big support system for me. My grandmother, my cousins. At the time, I had a brother that was also in prison as well.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I had a brother that was incarcerated. They allowed us to correspond with each other. And he sent me different letters and was encouraging me.
Robert's brother encouraged him to learn the law, which was even more difficult for him than we usually hear.
When I first went to prison, I could barely read. I remember when I first began to read the law, it was like, it was a whole nother language, you know, but I had some guys around me that helped me and steered me in the right direction. Actually, it was this older individual named James Edwards. He was actually wrongfully convicted as well. He was later exonerated as well. He helped me file my post-conviction.
Thankfully, Robert's co-defendants began to come clean. First, Jimmy Slaughter in 2001, and then Willie Doherty in 2003. Both of whom stated that Robert was in no way involved.
So he did a pro se filing in 2009, which is basically the same pleading that eventually got him released in 2025. So the way that it works in Illinois is you don't have a right to counsel for post-conviction. In Illinois, there's a statutory right to counsel if your post-conviction gets past the first stage, but you have to raise enough evidence to get there without a lawyer. So it's this bar already that people have. But Robert's case did get to the second stage. And so then he had a lawyer who filed an amended petition raising the same claims. That was in 2014. And this lawyer had an updated affidavit from Jimmy Slaughter. But the judge dismissed the petition at the second stage.
Which is pretty wild, considering that the only witness who said he was the shooter, Willie Doherty, was now literally saying that Robert was not involved at all, which was then corroborated by Jimmy Slaughter as well. And if you're going to say that now he's not credible, then when was he ever credible? Yet, still, this judge ruled in 2017 that the evidence of actual innocence, which was the recantation of the state's sole inculpatory witness, was somehow insufficient.
Which, what more do you want, right? It's not every case, especially now, has DNA or something that is a smoking gun. Most cases have eyewitness misidentification, which we didn't even have that here because the eyewitness said it wasn't Robert. That was appealed. So I think it was in 2018 that Allison Flowers, an investigative journalist, she had been looking into Robert's case, had written an article. It was the Invisible Institute. It was published in the Daily Beast, just doing fantastic work covering different witnesses, talking to different people, covering some of the misconduct in the case. And so she came to me and I took a look and we waited for that decision. And the appellate court remanded for the evidentiary hearing, saying basically that there was so little evidence against Robert to begin with that these witnesses would make a difference, you know, if they're credible. You need to at least listen to these people and see what they have to say.
That was all in 2020. And Lauren and the Exoneration Project began their reinvestigation to develop more evidence.
It was difficult to investigate and interview people in heavy COVID times, but eventually we were able to talk to a bunch of different people. Willie Doherty was the hardest one to get in touch with. We eventually did. I mean, understandably, Jimmy Slaughter also felt very bad about what had happened, but Willie was really devastated by having testified falsely against Robert. And Robert has already said that he doesn't blame them because he was in the same situation. He understands better than anyone else why Willie took that deal and why he did what he did.
In addition, Lauren and another attorney with the Exoneration Project, Megan Richardson, developed pattern and practice evidence, much of which had become available from other cases in which Detectives O'Brien and Moser had been exposed for the same kind of misconduct. And they were finally ready to supplement the petition in late 2023. They had the hearing in 2024, by which time Jimmy Slaughter and Willie Doherty had come clean with the fourth assailant, the same guy who Robert had said he'd seen walking with the group that night, Tremaine Taylor.
So Tremaine is deceased now. He was killed in, I think it was 2018. We're not able to talk to him, but Willie Doherty testified at our hearing, admitted his own involvement, and identified the other participants as Slaughter, Gilbert, and Taylor. He said that Tremaine had the gun, Robert wasn't there, wasn't involved at all, and that he basically fled as soon as it started to get questionable that, you know, he didn't think anyone was going to get hurt, is what he had said. And Jimmy Slaughter also admitted his own involvement and identified the other perpetrators as Doherty, Gilbert, and Taylor. Also said Tremaine had the gun and that Robert wasn't involved at all, wasn't even there. And then there were a number of people who came forward to say that Tremaine confessed to them at different points. So either right after it happened or a few years down the line, including his best friend, his own brothers. You know, his mom has spoken to different people, including journalists, and her belief and understanding is that her son did it. So we had the hearing in the fall, and the judge took it under advisement, basically, and was reviewing everything and was going to come back with her ruling in February, which was vacating Robert's conviction.
And I was just like, man, I heard my family back there hollering.
Which they're not supposed to do.
Yeah, the judge immediately got on them like, hey, don't do that anymore.
I mean, if there is ever a time to yell or whistle or whatever, this has got to be one of those times. This is February 19th, 2025.
Yeah, that is a memory that I relive over and over again. Like, I really can't even describe it. It was like a dream. Like, it was something that I waited for so long, that I prayed for, that I fought for, something that I thought wasn't even going to happen at some point, you know?
So the judge granted him bond and he then walked out that next day.
First, I had went back to my grandmother's house. My grandma said, I want you to walk through the door, because she kept on saying, every time that I talked to her in prison, I just want to see you walk through that door.
And she lived at the same house, right?
She did. That was another surreal moment, walking back into that house after 28 years and 10 months. It didn't even look the same, but it was home. So I ended up walking through the door, and she was like, everybody get a picture while you walking into the door. So I ended up walking in the door before somebody was able to take a picture. So she told me, no, you go back out. You walk back out. I had to walk back out and walk back in. And everybody took pictures of me walking in. And we talked for a brief moment. And I said, well, look, Grandma, the first thing I need to do is I need to jump in the tub. That's the first thing I want to do, is get in the bathtub.
And then soon thereafter, you got to be there for her 93rd birthday.
You know, I love telling this one particular story about her 93rd birthday. So every year, my grandma, while I was in prison, they asked her, what is your wish? And every year it has been to see my grandson come home. And they asked her again. And she said, I ain't got no wish this year. My wish is standing next to me. I got what I wished for. That's what we both wish for, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Makes me cry. Then it was, I think it was like a month later that we had the date for the state to decide, are we appealing? Are we moving forward with the trial, et cetera? And they came in and they dropped all the charges.
It's not like they had any evidence to present.
And so it was like the day after that, I think, right, that you got to leave for the Innocence Network conference in Seattle.
Yeah, I probably had the best time of my life there. It was so much love and support. And camaraderie, just a lot of people that was understood my feelings and my thoughts, and a lot of compassionate people as well that didn't go through what we went through, but they was outraged by people being wrongfully convicted and spending, you know, 20 and 30 years of their life in prison.
And our crew here at Wrongful Conviction, we never miss it. In fact, next year, it'll be in Chicago, and we're all looking forward to it. And if anybody listening wants to help Robert get back on his feet, his GoFundMe is linked here in the episode description. So please give if you can. And with that, we go to our closing. We want to give the last word to Lauren and Robert. So Lauren, how about we start with you? What do we want people to take away from this story in particular?
People who I've met who have gone through this, the people who have been wrongly convicted, are some of just the most amazing people that you could ever meet. Just the strongest, kindest, most grateful people. And Robert even tops all of that. I mean, he's just always been such a sweet person, so thoughtful, always asking after my kids and my family and concerned about how I'm doing when he's going through the worst possible thing anyone can go through. And I'm just so, like I said, lucky to know Robert, lucky that I got to work on his case, that I got to be one of the ones to bring the truth to light. And I'm grateful that I get to watch everything that he's going to do. He already has a job that he's really enjoying, and he's spreading the word about wrongful convictions. And I just feel so blessed to be even a small part of the story that is Robert Johnson.
Just a few people that I would like to just wholeheartedly thank them, because without them, I wouldn't be sitting right here. James Edwards, that helped me file my post-conviction. Adolfo Davis, who introduced me to a journalist. Her name is Elise. She talked to Allison Flowers. I want to thank Elise and Allison Flowers as well, who brought my case to Lauren and Megan. There's no words that I can express how thankful I am, how much I appreciate y'all. And I want to thank Natasha Tyler, because she fought hard for me. But I'll never forget that, ever. And last but not least, my family as well. What I would want people to take from this is that if you're on one of them jurors, don't just assume that a person that's sitting at that table is guilty because the police said he did it or the prosecutor said he did it. Really listen to the evidence, because there are people in prison for crimes that they did not commit. It is my understanding that Chicago is leading the nation in wrongful convictions right now. I just want people to bear in mind that these things happen a lot, and we need to do something to stop if I'm happening. And I do have one thing I would like to say for the man or the woman that's now in prison for a crime that they didn't commit. Keep your hope. Don't let them take that from you. Keep on fighting. It took me 28 years and 10 months. Don't never give up. I can almost bet you something will happen.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Kleiber. The music in this production was supplied by three-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good.
Just like great shoes, great books take you places. Through unforgettable love stories and into conversations with characters you'll never forget.
I think any good romance, it gives me this feeling of like butterflies.
I'm Danielle Robey, and this is Bookmarked by Reese's Book Club, the new podcast from Hello Sunshine and iHeart Podcasts, where we dive into the stories that shape us on the page and off. Each week, I'm joined by authors, celebs, book talk stars, and more for conversations that will make you laugh, cry, and add way too many books to your TBR pile. Listen to Bookmarked by Reese's Book Club on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I knew I wanted to obey and submit, but I didn't fully grasp for the rest of my life what that meant.
For my Heart Podcasts and Rococo Punch, this is The Turning, River Road. In the woods of Minnesota, a cult leader married himself to 10 girls and forced them into a secret life of abuse. But in 2014, the youngest escaped. Listen to The Turning, River Road on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I know a lot of cops, and they get asked all the time, have you ever had to shoot your gun? Sometimes the answer is yes. But there's a company dedicated to a future where the answer will always be no. This is Absolute Season 1. Taser Incorporated.
I get right back there and it's bad.
Listen to Absolute Season 1, Taser Incorporated, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.